From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today,
super excited to have you guys all here for a lot of reasons. One is I've never seen so many Latino people in one place all season long.
We follow along on an effort to get more Latinos out to our national parks and a documentary about farm workers and the big money behind food.
Hundreds of thousands of farmers have only a handful of supermarkets to sell their produce to. These supermarkets have a historically unprecedented amount of power.
We talked to the director about the fight for a living wage in the fields, plus a look at botanical health care, and the day my son was questioned about his citizenship. All this and more coming up on Latino USA as we talk about quality and control. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan.
La sonrisa ya nos ayudó comprando el disco. Ya bailar.
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Here in our newsroom, we got to thinking about quality and how what we consider quality often changes over time.
Well, I was a very pretentious kid when I was a kid.
That's Gael García Bernal, the Mexican actor known for critically acclaimed movies like The Motorcycle Diaries and Y Tu Mamá También.
Maybe I'm still, but now I'm a little bit older and less kind of insecure in many ways.
Gael's latest role is as a character known as Rodrigo, an eccentric conductor of a fictional New York symphony. It's called Mozart in the Jungle. Gael talked to us about how he doesn't listen to music in the same way he used to now.
As a young kid, I was very pretentious. So I would make an effort to listen to music to of all kinds, and even Carvo Par or Donatoni, you know, like very kind of simple nano music. And I would pretend that I would be interested in it. But of course, you need that knowledge of music to be able to experience it in a way, and knowledge of life as well. So I was not close to the classical music world at all, but I can't deny that I've been moved by it.
Now, in the same way that Gael wants to revisit classical music, in order to maintain quality, oftentimes things have to be revisited. They have to be reassessed. In this week's show, we're going to talk about quality and how we attempt to control it. Like a documentary filmmaker who wants to fix the way tomatoes are farmed in the United States. And we'll hear from a group of bloggers who are tasked with trying to get Latinos excited about nature and national parks. And finally, I'll let you in on my thoughts about the way we're treated as U.S. citizens in this country with a story about my son being questioned by immigration agents. But first, we're going to take a detour to California. The news now is all about the flooding in the northern part of the state. But for the past 3 years, the story in California has been the opposite, severe drought. But there's a stark disparity between those who are affected by the drought and those who aren't. In the state's rural Central Valley, where much of the country's produce is grown, the drought has had a direct impact on the lives of farm workers. Latino USA reporting fellow Vanessa Rancaño reports now from the area hardest hit, the Tulare Basin, at the southern end of the valley.
It's just after 6 a.m. and a group of grape pickers is getting ready for the day's work. The sun is just creeping up. It's still cold and damp in the field. They circle around the foreman to get their instructions for the day.
Okay, buenos dias a todos.
The foreman holds up a bunch of grapes. Some are plump and pink, others are shriveled and black.
Que por favor, tratar de limpiar lo más que se pueda.
Please do your best to clean these up, he tells the workers. You know why this is happening. The fruit's withered because there's no water.
¿Hay alguna pregunta? Pues si no hay ni una, en el nombre sea de Dios y pa' adelante.
Any questions, he asks? No? Then go for it. But that's not as easy as it sounds. Less water has been available to farmers this year than ever before in the state's history. And the situation is worst here, in the Central Valley. Experts project over $800 million in lost crop revenue, and with it 17,000 agricultural jobs. Some workers may even go back to Mexico.
Mi nombre es Antonio Ramírez. Pues aquí el mayordomo.
That's the foreman, Antonio Ramírez. He's been doing this work for 15 years.
40, porque muchos pues están yendo de aquí del valle.
Ramírez says he used to work with crews of 60 to 70 people, but this year he gets 45 at most. The people who used to help him are gone, he says, looking for work elsewhere. For those who stayed, it's tough.
Seguimos trabajando, pero hemos trabajado menos. Empezó más tarde la pizca.
We're still working, but much less, explains Adela Pérez. The harvest started late, and sometimes we go days without work. Pérez works quickly while she talks, snipping away rotten and underripe grapes and placing the best ones in plastic bins. She wears a sweatshirt with the hood cinched over her head and a bandana tied over her face to protect her from dust and pesticides. She says her income is down by as much as a third this year.
Se me hace que hasta los regalos de Christmas van a bajar.
Christmas presents are going to have to be smaller this year, Pérez says. Or maybe there won't be any at all. The drought is hitting home in other ways, too. More than 800 homes in Tulare County have run out of water, affecting over 3,700 people. Pérez lives in the community of East Porterville, where most homes rely on wells. Some, including hers, have started to go dry. She says one day she came home filthy after work, turned on her shower, and there was no water. She ended up going to a friend's house to wash. Her landlord eventually got the well working again, but the water it pumps comes out with dirt and sand, so she can't cook with it or drink it. Buying bottled water all the time puts even more strain on her reduced income. We have to buy it for everything, she says. And instead of selling it cheaper because people are in need, stores are charging more. They're taking advantage of us, she says. A few rows over, Jose Mejia is working next to his daughter.
En mis épocas he visto sequías, pero nunca como ahora.
Mejia has been working the fields around here for 40 years. He's seen some droughts in his time, he says, but never like this. The thirsty vines in this field produced fewer grapes than usual this year. That means a much shorter harvest and fewer hours for pickers. Plus, the grapes are smaller, and in such bad shape, the workers have to spend more time culling them. The result is that they pick less than they would otherwise and have less opportunity to make a bonus. Still, Mejia says they've been lucky.
Gracias a Dios hemos tenido suerte. Los que más han sufrido, más han batallado, son los que trabajan en el árbol, como la naranja.
He says the ones who are really struggling are the citrus workers. Gustavo Carranza is one of the many local citrus farmers struggling with his orange crop. We take a drive to survey the damage in the area. California's Central Valley produces a quarter of the nation's food, and close to half its fruit. Citrus alone brings in $2 billion. But today we pass dozens of acres of empty land where growers have ripped out their orchards. Some trees are pruned to the nubs to keep them alive on scant water. Many others are dying.
Well, you're looking at, again, 100-year-old trees that were very good producers. There's no bringing these trees back. You can see how the leaves are dried out. They're dropping now. But the winter months, all you're going to see is going to be the bare limbs on the trees.
We drive on and finally stop to look at some of Carranza's own trees.
This place where we're standing here was our very first ranch that we bought. 10 acres of navel oranges. I came here to the U.S. when I was 10 years old. My dad came here with the Bracero program when he was 18 years old. And he would come here and work, do seasonal work. Later, he brought his family over from Guanajuato, Mexico. And, you know, every weekend we knew what we were going to do. We were going to go pick oranges.
Carranza and his family now own 100 acres. He says when they got into the business, they asked around about water availability, and everyone told them the same thing. There had always been irrigation water for the farmers. But this year, for the first time, there isn't any. Not one drop. Because the water supply is so low. Carranza has had to rely on whatever limited well water he's had on hand, or buy emergency water from the local water district. He ended up buying water at nearly 10 times the normal price. but even that didn't help.
And the trees, when they got to have the water, you can't tell them to wait. They need the water, they need the water. And we got it 2 weeks too late. We couldn't get our money back. We knew we had lost our crop.
Carranza says at best he'll harvest a quarter of the orchard's normal crop. He says he'll be lucky if he makes back half the investment he put up for this harvest.
It's not a good situation. If it continues, you're going to see a lot more people going out of business. And as much as it hurts to say it, we might be next in line.
It's hard for him to understand.
The way we were brought up, that if you work hard and try to do something for yourself, at the end you will come ahead. And then all of a sudden, that doesn't matter anymore. If we don't have water, you don't have anything.
Carranza worries the result of all this will be the end of the small family farmer. If the drought continues, he says, it might be only the biggest growers who make it through. Growers like John Gless.
We're producers of Navel and Valencia oranges, grapefruits, lemons, and mandarins.
Gless and his family own 6,500 acres, spread across two counties.
This year, because we were able to get the water, with the exception of that 60 acres, we have a good crop. You know, it cost a lot of money to get it, but we were able to.
Growers like Gless are so big, they don't have to rely on just one single water district. They can also afford to drill extra wells, or even buy land, just for the water rights. Not only does Gless have a strong harvest, his operation is big enough to keep his farm workers busy year-round. But most of California's citrus farmers aren't so fortunate. And as they struggle, so do their workers.
Nosotros recibimos unas 20, 30 llamadas al día.
Antonio Cortez, an organizer with United Farm Workers, says the union gets 20 to 30 calls a day from workers asking where they can get help with food or bills. Sometimes there's nowhere to refer them. Cortez worries that things are going to get worse in the winter because there's generally less work. Statistics show that anywhere between 60 and 90% of farm workers in California are undocumented, so they can't claim unemployment benefits. Cortez says he's seen more and more families moving in together to make the rent, and others getting evicted because they can't. Back at the grape orchard, Adela Perez turns and looks up. Whenever we see a cloud in the sky, we thank God, Perez says. But it's like a trick. The rain almost never comes. For Latino USA, I'm Vanessa Rancagno in California's Central Valley.
To see photos of how the drought is affecting California's crops, visit our website, latinousa.org. And coming up on Latino USA...
On my bike. Today is a beautiful, sunny day. It's a little chilly. I think it's about 35 degrees out, so I'm pretty bundled up.
A family that bikes together somehow manages to stay together. That's coming up. No se vayan.
Thank you. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair, Japanese crafted with shiatsu point detection and 16 pre-programmed massages, including morning, night, and full body sessions. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And American Jewish World Service, working in developing countries to end poverty and advance human rights. Information at ajws.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And now we're going to talk about a documentary that made me think twice about the way I get my food.
Because now hundreds of thousands of farmers have only a handful of supermarkets to sell their produce to. These supermarkets have a historically unprecedented amount of power. When a company is able to dictate the pricing structure down its entire supply chain, a free market no longer exists.
That's a clip from the new documentary, Food Chains, narrated by Forrest Whitaker. The film tells the story of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, or the CIW. It's an organization of farm workers that's trying to get these powerful supermarket chains to pay workers, get this, just one extra penny for every pound of tomatoes they pick. That one extra penny, farm workers say, would bring them out of severe poverty. But the farm workers are facing an uphill battle. Sanjay Warwal is the film's director. He's here to talk about the film and the CIW's campaign. Sanjay, welcome to Latino USA.
Thank you so much, Maria. It's an honor to be here.
So why does your film and the farm worker campaign focus on supermarkets?
Supermarkets essentially control the terms all the way down the chain. So the CIW really flipped things on their end and are letting consumers know that these wonderfully friendly retailers like Publix in the South, like Safeway, like Kroger, that are totally family friendly, are directly responsible for the poverty of millions of people in this country.
For those of our listeners who don't know a lot about Immokalee and the Immokalee farm workers, who are they?
The Coalition of Immokalee Workers, or CIW, are a small group of tomato pickers from Central Florida. Tomato pickers and citrus pickers have been historically exploited in the state of Florida. The CIW, they began organizing in the mid-90s. They began protesting against farms. But they realized that the farmers, even the well-meaning ones, weren't being entirely responsive because they themselves couldn't afford to pay workers better. So the CIW circumvented that level of our distribution system and went directly to the gigantic buyers of tomatoes, to the Taco Bells, to the Whole Foods, to the Trader Joe's, and they asked them for two things. They asked for a one penny per pound bonus for the tomatoes that they picked. But more importantly, they developed a code of conduct. And if a tomato farmer in Florida breaks that code of conduct, they're no longer allowed to sell to now 12 of the largest tomato buyers in the world. And that was a revolutionary approach.
The film kind of takes on and makes an example of one of these big buyers, Publix grocery stores, and they haven't agreed to speak to either you or the farm workers.
Our film Food Chains has only been out for a little more than a week, but already the media response and the nationwide response of viewers has caused Publix to change its statement three times in the last week. Publix has always said that the issues that the CIW are facing, the poverty and their human rights exploitation, is a matter of employee-employer relationship. Now they're saying that they respect the Fair Food Program, they support the CIW, but they want to adhere only to the U.S. Department of Labor standards. I mean, the problem is the Department of Labor is so underfunded that it doesn't have enough manpower and woman power to enforce the existing laws in the books.
So why was the issue of farm workers the film that you decided to make?
Number one, my father is a tomato breeder, and I grew up in an agricultural family in California. Being from an agricultural family, I'd really never connected to farm workers. Trying to lead a spiritual life, my gratitude didn't really extend all the way down to the people that provided me my food.
What is the bigger takeaway that you want people to be left with, and what should they do about it?
Our farm economies in this country have been based on the labor of predominantly immigrant workforces, from the slaves that we brought from Africa to Latinos. And for too long, we've separated immigration from our food system And it's time for us not just to grant them legal status, but to ensure that the cycle doesn't continue. The CIW's program is a landmark program in the sense that it addresses the root causes of farm worker exploitation, and that's poverty.
Well, thanks so much for joining us on Latino USA, Sanjay. Congratulations on the film. It's beautiful.
Thank you. You know, it's in theaters now, and it's on iTunes as well. So, you know, people can go and download, people can watch it with their families, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook and really help us get this conversation going.
Sanjay Rawal is the director of the documentary Food Chains, which is out in theaters now. For more information, check out our website, latinousa.org. And now, from tomatoes to herbs. In the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, Jamaica, and the Amazon, rural and urban communities rely on plant-based medicine as their form of healthcare. When moving to the United States, members of these communities often continue using herbal remedies because of cultural ties, their faith, and because of the cost of healthcare. But what happens when plants get face-to-face with modern medicine? Laura Calzada has our story.
I'm at the New York Botanical Gardens in the Bronx. It is a cold December day. This place is huge and beautiful, a vast extension of green. I'm surrounded by children and families. In front of me is a miniature train passing through tiny mountains. The kids look amazed.
It's the holiday train show. One of the biggest attractions of the New York Botanical Garden every year.
This is ethnomedical researcher Ina Vandenbroek. She identifies the plants that Latino communities are using for different health conditions and pairs the common name with the botanical identity.
This plant belongs to the genus Costus. It's closely related to the ginger family. It's a family that's called Costaceae. And this is a plant that the Dominican community calls insulina. And they use it frequently to treat diabetes. The upper parts, a tea is brewed from them. And people say it keeps their sugar levels under control.
Dr. Vandenbroek takes the first step, identifying this plant so that biologists can study their efficacy and potential toxic components.
This plant has been very poorly studied in the laboratory. And that's what's happening with a lot of the plants that Dominican and other Latino and Caribbean communities are using in New York City as well.
The tour continues in this hot environment of the tropical rainforest. We discover the tasty guanabana, sour sap in English, and zapote, an edible fruit used for medical purposes. The seed is grated, made into a tea, and given to children to treat asthma.
There can be some problem with using that seed because it contains compounds that release hydrogen cyanide and can be toxic. But of course, what is a poison and what is a medicine always depends on the dose. More research needs to be done from that point. But before we can do that research, we have to know what are the kind of plants that they're using and what are they using it for.
So I called Michelle Dominguez. She works at an herbal retail store in the Bronx called 21 Division. People come to places like 21 Division to buy their plants and remedies. There are 60 botanical stores in just the Bronx alone. So who buys there?
Some women who are young, who can't have children, who we sell a mixture of plants to help them be able to conceive. Also women who have menstrual issues, older people. If it's younger people, it's more basically for spiritual uses, not more medicinal. Most of the time, if the younger person doesn't know of what something that's good, that's a natural medicine, then their parents come in or their grandparents come in and buy it for them. Myself, because I'm early 30s, I learned a lot of those remedies from my parents. Honestly, most of our older clients refuse to take any medication that's prescribed.
What do the medical doctors have to say about all this? I asked Dr. David Perez, who works at the pharmaceutical company Cigna.
Latinos and Caribbeans believe in the cultural care that they've received, and so they're not going to abandon it. And so there's a need to respect for the care that's given, but it's also important to understand when that care has potential for adverse side effects. If you're well-trained, you believe in what you do, and you believe that what somebody may be doing is myth. So there needs to be created an understanding of what that myth is, what is real, what is beneficial and what is potentially toxic.
And this understanding is what Ina Vanderbroek is creating by teaching medical students and physicians about the use of herbs in plant-based medicine. So they become more culturally sensitive to this reality and know how to respond to their patients. And what about younger generations? What do they do when they don't feel well? One girl I talked to, named Yaelis, told me she turns to her grandmother, who always has something to heal her. She even plans to pass her grandmother's remedies on to her own children and even grandchildren. So plant remedies aren't going anywhere. And no doubt they will be coexisting with pharmaceutical drugs. The only worry is that there isn't enough research yet on how these two forms of medicine interact. For Latino USA, I'm Laura Calzada.
And now, querido listeners, we're going to head outside. We want to introduce you to the Camper Clan, a family that spends most of their time outdoors. Camper Dad is from Argentina. Camper Mom is American from Montana. Their two kids have spent most of their lives out on the road. We've been following their travels since they set out to break the world record for electric biking all the way across the U.S. And we finally caught up with them as they came through New York.
Hi, I'm Dylan Drake, and I'm the mom of Camper Clan. And we are a family that has been traveling for a year and a half across the Americas. Our kids are Ava, who is 4, and Constantino, who just turned 3. And we realized we had another year before our oldest child started school. So we decided, hey, let's just do one more trip and do something that really means something to us. And that's why we picked the electric bicycle. And, hold on here. What's wrong?
Sorry, I got to interrupt, but Popo just pooped his pants.
Pooped his pants? Yes, oh, my gosh.
This
sorry.
Hasn't happened in like 6 months, but he just decided to poop. Oh, okay. So, let me, sorry, no. I just grabbed pants and I go all... It's part of... ¿Qué pasó, Coco?
I have the wipes are in my purse, sweetie. You know where you put my pants?
I'm Tomás Cortijo and... I'm just a regular dad, and I'm riding my electric bike to break a world record. We're riding across America, east to west, from Montana to Maine, and now we're on the south portion, going from Maine to Florida. We're trying to ride about 6,000 miles on an electric bike. That's about 1,800 miles more than the current world record. The goggles for safety and the helmet. I put a very powerful horn so I'm noticed when I'm riding. And we also want to do it with our kids to show people that you don't need to stay at home and adventures don't stop when you have kids, that you can still go and do great things with your kids and include them into the in the adventure. And they love it. They love every minute of it.
We're getting ready to go, mi amor.
Hotel. Papa's going to get on the bike.
To the pool right now.
Well, first we're going to go to the pool. While Papa rides his bike, we're going to go swim in the pool.
And
we
spend
the first 2 hours of the day getting the kids ready, looking at the map, planning. And then around 11, we get on the road. Dylan goes her way, and I get on the bike and start pedaling.
Can we sing it in English?
I don't think that song translates into English.
Why?
Well, not all things translate between the languages, you know? Papa sings that song, that's right. Are we going to find Papa somewhere on the road here?
Oh, my bike. Today is a beautiful sunny day. It's a little chilly. I think it's about 35 degrees out, so I'm pretty bundled up. But it's a beautiful ride, the one that I have today. I'm going from Fredericksburg, Virginia, to Richmond, Virginia. I'm riding on the 301, and the winter I'm starting to feel the winter, and there's a little bit of wind, but it's just peaceful. Well, not that peaceful. There's a little bit of traffic because it's kind of a main road. It's not a trail day today. About 2-3 hours later, we meet
We play with the kids for a couple hours, have lunch.
Hi, Papa.
How awesome. After that, we continue to ride for another 2 or 3 hours to our next destination where we find a place to either camp, or now that the campgrounds are closed, we find a motel to stay. And get up the next morning and repeat.
Sweetie, put your phone down. We're having breakfast. No devices at the table.
Papa's putting too much sugar on his...
Papa puts a lot of sugar on his cereal, doesn't he?
Yeah. Let me catch. That's not healthy.
That's because this... this is granola. It doesn't have sugar on it.
Finding a place to cook and finding a place to buy the right food is challenging. And we got to take things slow. We can't rush kids. They want to play. They need their time to play. So everything is slow. If you would do this trip solo, you might be able to go 150 miles a day. I have only a window to ride 4 or 5 hours a day, so we can do all the kid stuff.
Let's do some math problems while we're driving, huh?
Yeah.
Now if you have 5 apples and you have to give away 1 apple, how many apples are left?
27.
I think it's normal life for them. You know, we've been doing this since they were really small. And I think they are starting to get to an age where they realize that there's people that don't do this. And they ask sometimes, are we going to live in a house? So we explain, we are going to live in a house. We do have a home and we will be living there soon.
We just love being with our kids. We just can't think any better way to spend our day than being with Eva and Coco and helping them grow and growing ourselves.
You know it. Po Pepe?
The Camper Clan is just wrapping up their trip in the Florida Keys, but they've already broken the Guinness World Record for electric biking by biking over 1,000 miles. To connect with them on social media and see their awesome pictures, check out our website, latinousa.org. Coming up on Latino USA.
This is not how the United States is being sold outside here and even in here. I mean, I didn't even know about the national park.
A push to get Latinos to our national parks. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Que para ti
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all, on the web at rwjf.org, and the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The United States has a massive national park system. You know, places like Yosemite or the Grand Canyon. But while the park saw over 270 million visitors last year, very few of them were Latino. Now, the Park Service is trying to address this, and Latino USA producer Daisy Rosario followed along with a group of Latinos who are tasked with helping to bring more Latinos out into the wilderness and our national parks.
Hi, guys. My name is Millie Jimenez. I'm the Diversity Outreach and Volunteer Coordinator. I'm here in the park, and I am so excited you guys are here. I've been waiting. It's like Christmas, you know? You're like
Park Ranger Millie Jimenez greets eight bloggers over breakfast at the Togedy Mountain Lodge in Wyoming. It's the first day of the American Latino Expedition. These bloggers have been chosen to take a four-day trip through Grand Teton National Park. Once at the park, they meet Grand Teton Deputy Superintendent Kevin Schneider inside a visitor center.
I don't want to talk for too long because this room is nice, but it's a lot nicer when you start hiking.
Latinos have notoriously low visitorship to the national parks.
The national parks collectively, these 401 different places, tell the story of our nation's heritage.
And it's something the National Park Service, the government entity that manages the parks, wants to change. But the NPS isn't allowed to spend the taxpayer money they get from Congress on marketing, so they have to be creative.
The National Park Service is a lot more than that. We protect places like the home and birthplace of Dr. Martin Luther King in Atlanta, Georgia.
Their official charity, the National Park Foundation, raises private funds for the parks, and they've partnered with various sponsors to take these social media influencers on an adventure. The bloggers will in turn share their own stories with their followers in an effort to reach Latinos around the U.S.
So if you think of the National Park Service as telling the stories of who we are as Americans, we're also incomplete.
While Latinos don't often visit the park, the area of Wyoming where the park is located has more Latinos than people realize.
Here in Jackson, would you believe that something like 25% of the town of Jackson, Wyoming, is Latino? A lot of people don't.
That was surprising to learn.
Don't realize that, yeah. A huge percentage. In my daughter's preschool, about half of her preschool is Latino. And that's true as she when she goes into kindergarten, it's going to be throughout her schooling here.
From there, it's on to a hike with a ranger named Katie.
I'm just going to stop here briefly and honor this before we get too far. Does anyone know what kind of tree this is?
An aspen?
Yeah, this is an aspen tree.
The bloggers come from around the U.S. A few are from Texas, one from California. Chicago, New York City, and Colorado are also represented. They also have different specialties. Some are food bloggers, others focus on tech, cars, and general lifestyle information. One is a gardener. Another focuses on photography. At a waterfall, I ask Ray Nuez Jr. about what he thinks of the view. It's immediately clear which blog is his.
I wish there were more clouds in the sky. I wish the sun was lower, because it makes the image more dramatic. But it's pretty awesome.
And it wouldn't be a proper hike through actual wilderness without some talk of poop.
There's some droppings at that tree right there. They're like about this big. Mm-hmm. What would that? Sure. Too small to be a bear, so I'm not scared.
Yeah. It'd be okay. We saw some different ones. So was it in the shape of pellets or was it like in a line?
Ovally?
Yeah.
Later that night, the bloggers head into the city of Jackson and have dinner with local Latino leaders. The next day, the group rides to another part of Grand Teton in an RV. On the first day, the bloggers seem to just be taking it all in. After a night's sleep, some of the women are already processing their experience. Melanie Mendez-Gonzalez has a blog that focuses on reconnecting to her Latina roots.
You know, like in my application, when they were talking about have you been to the parks and whatnot, and I said, no, I've never been, because though my parents were always working one, if not two jobs. So vacation time was like, you go see other family that you haven't seen because you don't get to see them because everybody's working.
Right.
And things like this was not even,
a possibility.
Thought.
Right.
Yeah, like you didn't think.
I feel like if you brought them, them seeing this, then they'd be like, ay, pero mira que bonito. Like all of a sudden that would change the experience. But it's like when you don't know what you don't know, you don't know what you're missing out on.
Back in Grand Teton, it's time for another hike and to meet another ranger. Ricardo Torres.
All right. Well, again, my name is Ricardo, and I want to welcome all of you guys.
Ranger Ricardo is the second Latino NPS staffer the bloggers have met.
Super excited to have you guys all here for a lot of reasons. One is, I've never seen so many Latino people in one place all season long. I've seen more people from China and other places, like, so this is pretty awesome. It's also nice to see other faces, you know, kind of like how I am. So I'm also a proud Latino.
Both he and Millie are products of the NPS Academy. It's a program that tries to encourage students of underrepresented backgrounds to pursue careers in the Park Service.
So I was born in the U.S. My family, my mother and my father were born in Mexico, came to the States, worked as migrant workers. So I never was really introduced to national parks growing up. My family didn't really have a lot of money to travel. But I did always hear about these amazing, you know, wilderness areas.
Ranger Ricardo's focus at the park is as a naturalist. He shows the group berries growing in the wild.
I just want to point out some other really delicious berries down here.
Oh, yay.
These, with these big, broad leaves right here. These are thimbleberries. I personally think they're better.
Blogger Daily Baez describes the flavor of the berries. And you can hear why it would be special for Ranger Ricardo to get to show Latinos around the park.
It's like tamarindo taste. Yeah, it tastes like tamarindo to me.
They will eat.
Right? It tastes like tamarindo to me.
Oh, my God.
You know what? I never thought about that, but that's
yes,
true.
Yes, it's like tastes like tamarindo, but yes.
Huh. Yeah, I haven't had tamarindo in a long time.
Oh, my God. You should have told me so.
You're making me miss home.
The group takes a tough and sometimes scary hike up to Inspiration Point. Later, they hurry back to the hotel before an important event. An event most people visiting the national parks wouldn't do. As part of the trip, the bloggers have to take part in a Twitter party, trying to engage people online. These are the sounds of a Twitter party. It's a bunch of people sitting at one long table, each on their laptops. It looks more like they're studying for finals than having a party. After all the excitement of the Twitter party winds down, it's time for dinner. And then bed. On the third day, the bloggers are heading out on an all-day trip to Yellowstone National Park.
Look. Welcome to Yellowstone. How are you today?
Thank you. Great.
The group visits some hot springs. Melanie describes the scene.
What I see right now are small pools of water looking like they're steaming. And around the edges, you can start to see the different bacteria.
Sean Beckett of Teton Science Schools is their guide for the day. He pulls the van over to check something he sees in the distance.
A squirrel. Yeah. I guess that was enough. It was a squirrel or what?
It was, hang on a second.
Uh-oh.
Something good.
It was a bison.
Oh.
It was lying down. It was real far away. And okay. I think we can improve upon that sighting. So we'll keep going and see what else is in the rest of the valley. Yep, we can improve upon that sighting. Behold, 100 bison.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow.
Blogger Liza Monet Morales is loving it.
Amazing. Like, it just literally takes your breath away because I've only seen, this is going to sound so cheesy, but I've only seen them in books in school. So to actually see them live, and they're just chilling. They're like sunning, doing their thing, uninterrupted, is so freaking cool, especially because it's such an open and vast area. I love that they feel safe and that they're at home and that we can be here to enjoy it.
Back in the van, we finally get to the question of, why don't Latinos go to the parks? Before I reported this story, one Latino friend told me she thought her family never went to the parks because as immigrants trying to make it in the U.S., the last thing they wanted to do with their free time was sleep on the floor outside. Fair enough. Recently on Latino USA, a guest mentioned that undocumented people get nervous at the sight of the park rangers because their uniforms look like military uniforms, which is understandable. NPS uniforms are actually specifically designed to look like an old Army Ranger uniform. So that could be a reason. The group had a few other ideas, too.
The average person, I'm sure, has a hard time coming out here, especially with the family of 2, 3, 4 kids nowadays.
Like, for example, I mean, I just came here 6 years ago. So this is not how the United States is being sold outside here and even in here. I mean, I didn't even know about the national parks and that all this, you know, is here and that you can enjoy it and visit and, you know, and it's because of the media. I mean, that's not what they sell.
Here's what blogger Ramon Gonzalez has to say.
Price or the costs of it
where is it within reach? I mean, you have people marching in the streets for $15, $15 an hour wages. Is a person on $15 an hour, can they afford to, one, house and feed their family themselves, obtain a vehicle? I mean, think about it. A lot of people in big cities don't own vehicles, don't have driver's licenses. So how would they get here?
As the person in the van who spends the most time in the parks, and as an educator, Sean, the guide, was eager to learn from the bloggers.
As the face of America changes, the parks have really struggled to keep up. What sorts of things would you like to see in the parks? What changes can be made to better cater to those experiences?
Sean tells the group a story someone told him about a park where Latino visitors would often move the picnic tables around to be able to sit in groups. The staff there had to reset the tables every day. Eventually, the staff got tired of doing this and they chained the tables down. And the Latino visitors stopped coming. Maybe there isn't one answer as to why Latinos don't go to the parks, but it is a question worth asking. On the final morning, the bloggers had the option of taking a float down a river or going horseback riding. Then they regroup for a scenic cruise of Coulter Bay. Then it's on to the final event of the trip. Dinner with Grand Teton National Park Superintendent David Vela.
What's up, man? David Vela, mucho gusto.
Superintendent David Vela is a rarity in the NPS.
I am the only Latino senior executive in the National Park Service.
And is that at the highest level?
The highest level before you become a presidential appointee.
Yeah.
I'm the first Latino to run a senior executive park unit. So stories are important. And so what we want to do is to tell our community to say, hey, did you know that these stories belong to you? And you know you can find them in your national parks?
Well, listening to you talk and talk about your family and the full circle thing, yeah, makes me realize that you and us and Ricardo and Millie, that's
the story.
We are
the story.
We are the story. And we're writing our stories.
As the sun sets and the meal wraps up, the bloggers are met with one final surprise. They're becoming junior rangers. It's just a fun, free visitor program targeted at kids. But for the bloggers, it's extra special to be sworn in by the superintendent himself.
I need all the junior rangers to raise your right hands. Okay. Repeat after me. As a junior ranger, I promise to appreciate, respect,
and protect
Grand Teton National Park and the natural world, wherever I go.
Congratulations.
You're now official. Congratulations.
To give it to my daughter. So excited.
Thank you,
guys. Oh, so cool.
For Latino USA, I'm Daisy Rosario.
And now, my dear listeners, to end our show, a little bit of sabiduría in the form of a story that involves my son. It all started as a very proud moment for our family. Our firstborn son was coming home by train from his first semester at college in Chicago. On the train, he slept all night. And by the time the train got to Buffalo in the next afternoon, he was wide awake. And that's when I got his frantic texts. Mom, somebody just got on the train and asked if I was a citizen. This is crazy. Everyone on the train looked at each other and we were like, can you believe this just happened? Yes, officials who look like police actually getting on a train in the United States of America and asking people to show their papers. Is this who we've become? Frankly, it just breaks my heart as a mom and as an American, because that's not the country I pledge my citizenship to. My country is based on the beliefs of innocent until proven guilty, due process, equality, and freedom from Big Brother. Of course, it happens to be that immigrants are actually the very basis of this country, people all over the world coming here. That is who we are, or who we think we are. The criticism of President Barack Obama's recent executive action on immigration has been swift and deep. and the president may have pushed his own limits, but the policy recommendations have in fact divided this country one more time, slicing and dicing families like good old American pie. You can stay, but your dad and your sister can't. How American is that? Now, Border Patrol agents are charged with dividing families, making choices like, you, you're a good immigrant, you get to stay. But you over there, you're a bad immigrant, and you have to go. President Obama says only criminals will be deported. Yet as we speak, in Texas, this very month, a brand new detention center for families, mothers, and children is going to open. Children behind bars, paid for by your taxpayer dollars. The president's November address did seem heartfelt on his part, like he was finally exhaling this pain that he's been carrying on his shoulders, the pain of family separations. And the president was asking all of us the question that my son's own experience raised to me. Is this who we are in this country? Is this who we've become? And do we have to continue to be this way? Remember, the immigration agents on that train in Buffalo weren't just asking brown people for their citizenship. They were also asking the sons and daughters of every other American, which is strange because we know that immigration agents boarding a train and asking for your papers isn't normal. That's the stuff of Hollywood. It's a shock and, yes, a horror. That's not us. Or is it? And on that note, my dear listeners, that's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Laura Calzada and Julia Hsu. And this is Julia's last week with us. Thank you for all of your work, and thank you, NYU. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, we'll see you on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the strengthening of international peace and security at carnegie.org. And Latino USA is also supported by REI, supporting today's youth to develop a lifetime commitment to nature and the outdoors. And the California Endowment, building a strong state by improving the health of all Californians.
Let's not make this about mate.
Okay.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.com. And the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org. This is NPR.